Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Missing Frames, the first Missing Frames of 2019. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge, and I needed an amazing host to be with me in this pivotal episode, just kicking off the new year, right? So I'm bringing Mr. Daniel Rayner back on the show for the first time since we watched My Dinner with Andre together. Dan, welcome back.
Hey, I'm back out of retirement.
It's good to have you back. And we're going to be talking about, we're going a little Kubrick crazy here on Missing Frames. Mm. I know we did Superman last time, but the one before that was 2001, A Space Odyssey. And this episode, we're going to be focusing on one of Kubrick's earlier films, Paths of Glory, which neither of us have seen.
Neither of us have seen. Also, note that Kubrick crazy is spelled with two K's.
I actually spelled it wrong in my notes. When I was typing that, I had a moment where I was like, oh, I should make that a K. I don't know why I didn't. And now I feel even more embarrassed about it because you pointed it out. But we've talked a little bit. If you go back and listen to the 2001 A Space Odyssey episode I did with my wife, Sarah, I kind of go very in depth about my experience with Kubrick. He's one of the great filmmakers of all time. We watched 2001 in 4K, which just is stunning. And I know you and I, Dan, when I first got 2001, you came over and we were like, let's just put on the last 30 minutes and just watch the crazy space insanity. But I adore that movie and I love Kubrick, but I've only seen his films following Dr. Strangelove, which, as far as I'm aware, is pretty much the dividing line between, or like there's before Dr. Strangelove and there's after Dr. Strangelove. And I haven't seen anything before Dr. Strangelove. So this is exciting for me. I got a couple Criterion Blu-rays for Kubrick. I got this and The Killing. And I'm really excited to watch this because I've heard a lot of good things about it. But Dan, you are a Kubrick fan on another level. How do you feel about Stanley Kubrick?
I adore him. I think he's probably the greatest filmmaker who's ever lived. And I know that's said a lot, but I actually have not seen many of his movies before Dr. Strangelove either. I think it is kind of a dividing line in his career. I did see Killer's Kiss, which is solid, but not, you know, on the same level as the other stuff.
I think that's included on The Killing Blu-ray too.
I believe so,
which is great.
And I haven't seen Lolita. I haven't seen
Spartacus. That's another one.
He kind of disowned that. He said he only really directed the first third of it. The rest of it was, since he didn't write it or anything, he's brought on last minute to direct that.
And that's like it's like a sword and sandals movie, isn't it? Like a big epic, like studio epic. It feels very, that's one I forget he was involved with.
Yeah, again, he was kind of before he was famous, he was kind of a studio director. He was a name thrown out after, I believe, the director quit or was fired on that project.
Yeah, I want to look this up. I want to see where exactly this falls in his filmography. Because I think so Spartacus came after Paths of Glory, which sense, because Kirk Douglas is in both of them. He's the star. Yeah. I think, so it makes sense that he probably brought Kubrick on to Spartacus. This is what I'm assuming. I haven't actually looked at anything, but it makes sense. But Paths of Glory was 1957. Spartacus was 1960. Mm. It's crazy to think that Kubrick was making like black and white movies in the 40s and 50s.
It's pretty amazing. In his first film, Fear and Desire, which another film he's actually kind of disowned. He says it's pretentious, and he's said, you know, as a learning,
if Kubrick thinks it's pretentious, that's a big deal.
That actually was just released not too long ago on Blu-ray for the first time. I haven't seen it, but
nice.
For the longest time it was only DVD and it was out of print, and there are very few places you could actually see that. I think it's on Amazon now too.
Okay.
I guess I should talk about how I got into Kubrick.
Yeah, please do. I don't think I've heard this story.
Well, I like everybody, I heard he was a great director, and I'd seen, you know, some stuff in college. I believe I saw The Shining first and some of his other movies. And the moment I realized it was something kind of beyond your average great filmmaker, Hitchcock was one of my first favorite, you know, sort of auteur filmmakers, was I saw the documentary Room 219, I believe.
237.
237, okay.
You saw that before The Shining?
No, I saw it after The Shining. Okay. But Room 219 is actually the real room where it happens.
Okay.
So, but I remember just seeing all these, half the people on there are nuts. And the other half, it's really fascinating.
I've got to see this document. I've never seen it, and I desperately want to because I hear it's insane.
It really is. And I started to kind of delve into that world of semi-conspiratorial Kubrick fans. And I read a very lengthy, like, master's thesis or something. It was about Full Metal Jacket, breaking it down from the perspective of, like, Jungian psychology. And every line of dialogue lines up with Carl Jung. And I started to realize this filmmaker was just on a different level. The beauty of Kubrick, the thing that draws me to him and kind of keeps me fascinated, is a lot of artistic filmmakers can make a weird, artsy, esoteric film, and it can be great, but it won't have mass appeal. It won't really tell a story. It'll be, you know, artsy and avant-garde and weird. Kubrick managed to make entertaining films. Full Metal Jacket's a war movie. Shining's a horror movie. 2001's a space movie, even though that's rather avant-garde and weird.
Mm.
But at the same time, layer in so many layers of philosophy and kind of artistic levels. 2001, the way the stars are, the constellations have different astrological significance.
Yeah, didn't he go to the extreme of, he actually talked to astronomers to figure out, like, okay, if it's this time of day, where would the star patterns be? I feel like I've heard that rumor.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe that was Gravity, which is a movie that was a lot to 2001, but also I wouldn't be surprised if Kubrick did do that.
Well, I know for a fact he looked into, like, ancient...
My cat's crawling on me, and Dan's admirably trying not to be distracted by it.
It's like tangled in his headphones right now.
So yeah, Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah,
what does my cat have to say about Stanley Kubrick?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, he looked into, from what I understand, he looked into Far Eastern astrology from, like, Mesopotamia, different dynasties and stuff, and just so many layers of symbolism. Something like Ulysses or Gravity's Rainbow or something like that, like a sort of modernist novel.
Yeah,
where there's just all these layers of significance, and it's kind of mind blowing that somebody could write or direct or create on so many different levels and still have something that's compelling on just a surface, you know, enjoyment watching a movie level.
Right. He never compromised his artistic integrity for entertainment value. He is extremely cinematic, but he's also making movies. I think as an American filmmaker, I don't know, he may be the most, like, postmodern American filmmaker of that era. Is that a stretch to say? I'm trying to think of other filmmakers that were out around that time that were doing, specifically American filmmakers, that were doing things as cerebral and as artsy as he was on the same scale.
I don't think anybody was nearly as cerebral or artsy as him, but I wouldn't use the word postmodern. I think of very different films when I kind of hear that term. We were talking before we started recording about Charlie Kaufman, and I think he would be defined as a postmodern sort of writer and director. I think Kubrick was more of, like, a modernist, like a Joyce, like a Proust even in some ways. His work has all these layers of significance. With postmodernism, you get kind of a fractiousness. You get questions that aren't answered. You have stuff that isn't quite rounded off and lots of ambiguity. Especially with like Kaufman and Spike Jonze and people like that.
Right.
David Cronenberg.
But do you think the sterile, very calculated framing and things like that, is there an element of postmodernism to that? Like, almost in a way, it is so disconnected sometimes emotionally in an observant kind of way?
Perhaps. I can see it, like, kind of, like, moving that way. It's interesting with, like, modernist painting. You get this kind of removal of perspectile art. You lose the perspective. Things start to, it's not abstract, but things start to, the objects within themselves are not part of a scene seen by a subject. They're kind of separated and disjointed. And perhaps you could kind of, like, see some of that in Kubrick, but I would say he's definitely, if we're talking about art and we're talking about, like, authors, I would say, like, James Joyce is probably when I think of, like, an analogy.
Gotcha. And what was, do you remember, was the Shining was the first one you saw, so were you on board immediately, or did it take you a little bit to really, like, was it something else that really got you into him where you finally connected?
The Shining, the first time I watched it, I think you grow as like a person who appreciates art and film. And I watched The Shining, and I watched it, you know, just pure surface level. Somebody told me it was the scariest film ever made. And I watched it. And I'm like, I mean, it's interesting, yeah, but it's not scary.
I think there are a couple, it's funny, there are a couple lists out there. I laugh, but I mean, it is terrifying. I would probably put it as one of my top five favorite scary movies. But I think, I mean, there are lists out there that have had it at number one, definitely in top three, top five territory.
The moment that I really realized kind of the brilliance of The Shining and then just a lot of his other movies, Eyes Wide Shut is one of my favorites. I think 2001 is my favorite, but there's a sign that you see in the background of the ski lodge, and it shows somebody skiing. And it's really weird because they say in the dialogue in the film, they say there's no good ski slopes around here. That's why we close in the winter. Mm. And if you kind of look at the silhouette of somebody skiing, you realize like it has a kind of foreshortened perspective, big upper torso, small legs. And you realize it's a minotaur. Like it's very obvious once you kind of see it. The end of the movie is a labyrinth, you know, right, with that theme. And essentially, like, one of the theories about The Shining, which I like a lot, it's about the horrors of the past. The Indian burial ground, different Holocaust references, stuff like that. And the question posed is, how do we get out of this cycle of destruction as a human race? Mm. And the answer is in the final climax of the film, where Danny, in the snow, in the labyrinth of, you know, kind of human misery, he retraces his steps and he gets out of the maze.
Right.
Which is beautiful and moving on a completely different level than the surface of what's actually happening in the film. Some people will say that's reading way too much into it.
I don't know. Kubrick has proven time and time again that he was an obsessive perfectionist.
Oh, yeah.
I would not be. The 237, the Room 237 stuff, again, I haven't seen the documentary. I know some people go nuts. But some of the stuff I do, like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Kubrick had been like, oh, yeah, that's right.
There's certain, like, even continuity errors that are picked up on. And just, again, knowing how obsessive he was. Mm. I don't believe they're accidents, and there are other things where people, I think, do read a little too much into it. I'm more skeptical about the moon landing stuff, but it is kind of interesting to see Danny with a Apollo sweater on,
right,
stuff like that. And I can't tell if it's Kubrick just toying with the audience a little bit or having an in joke, but it's interesting, and it's worth just, at the very least, watching the documentary.
Okay, cool. My biggest question, I think, going back to Paths of Glory, is whether or not we will see that obsessive Kubrick, if he felt he could get away with stuff. I hear this movie's amazing, but I wonder if maybe studio pressure, or maybe just his inexperience, if we'll see less of that, like, kind of the Kubrick we know based on the movies we've seen, and a little more rawness and a little more, maybe not slapdash, but a little less refined of a visual aesthetic.
I feel like, I think it was Barack Obama who said, it's a job like any other. You get better the more you do it. I just like that quote. And I think even being like a brilliant weirdo, auteur, a hermit, madman that Kubrick was, I think it applies to him. I think his movies do kind of show like a progression. Having seen like Killer's Kiss, it definitely feels, there are touches of Kubrick there, but it's definitely unformed.
Right.
I've only seen frames in like little clips from Paths of Glory. I believe the frames are kind of Kubricky, lots of elaborate framing and staging of actors and props.
Yeah.
But I'm very excited to see.
Yeah, I don't know much about this movie. I know Kirk Douglas is in it. I know it's black and white, and I know it's about World War I, but I don't know many other details.
I know a little bit, but I'm not going to say.
Okay, and I also know it was nominated for Best Film at the BAFTAs, but it lost to Bridge on the River Kwai, which I don't think I've seen that.
That's
either.
Great.
It is? Okay, awesome. So, but it's just interesting. I don't. Is Bridge on the River Kwai also World War I?
World War II.
World War II, okay.
It's very much, I don't mean this as to denigrate the film, because it's an excellent film. It's a dad movie.
Okay. It's very Hollywood.
It's very Hollywood. It's very beautifully shot. It's a fun movie. It's something your dad watches at 2 p.m. on TNT and says, I caught that on the TV the other day. It was a good movie.
It's good. It still holds up. Yeah. So that's about all I know about it. And I know it's short. It's a short movie. Did I say that already?
Oh.
No, I didn't. Okay. It's like an hour and 28 minutes.
No way.
Which is shocking.
Wow.
I think that's partly why we did it. We've been talking about a future episode we will do Barry Lyndon, because I know that's one of your favorites.
Oh, yeah.
And I have not seen Barry Lyndon, but that's nearly, what, 3 hours long?
Over 3 hours with an intermission.
Right. So that's partly why we're not watching this, because it's late and we're watching a shorter movie. But I'm excited mainly because, again, this is coming from a Kubrick era that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
And it'll be exciting to see, because like you, he's one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. I think he's one of the greats. So it'll be really cool to see something a little bit more from his formative years.
I'd be interested to know, just, I know we didn't plan this or anything, but top of your head, if you could say the top five greatest filmmakers.
God, I don't think I could. I mean, personally, I'd have to go with personal favorites.
Sure,
and then I'd have to think about that. Kubrick would definitely, if I were to be unbiased, it would be like, he's definitely up there. I'd put Spielberg there. Personally, Linklater. Who else? God, Kurosawa.
Mm.
Bergman. Ingmar Bergman, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a tough question. I can't do that off the top. What about you?
These are a little bit less my favorites. I think they're more... They're not stuff I watch for fun, per se. Like,
people are going to think I'm such a pretentious ass based on those.
Wait for mine.
I mean, at least I got Spielberg in there. I swear, like, I'm like, you've heard me talk about it, and if you've tuned into other shows on the Nerd Party, like Filibuster or wherever else I've guessed, you've heard me geek out about, like, how much I love Marvel movies and stuff. I swear I'm not, I am a snob, but I'm not so snobby as to, like, dismiss popular entertainment.
Sean's a man's man.
I'm a man's man.
He's an everyman.
we're cuddling as we record this episode, in case you're wondering.
My top five, I would say Kubrick is probably, I don't think anybody kind of touches him. Bergman, Truffaut, Fellini, Kurosawa.
That's a good list. Fellini, I haven't seen any Fellini. That's another one we should do.
7.5 is really, really good.
Yeah, that's 7.5. Is it 9.5?
8.5, sorry.
8.5.
Yeah.
God, you and neither of us were right. So we're not film snobs at all. So you can keep listening to this episode. But we're going to go ahead. We'll watch Paths of Glory, and then we will be back to discuss it.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Well, that was not at all what I expected. That was so depressing.
Yeah.
but absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the stuff we discussed beforehand, a lot of the questions about how Kubrickian, is that a legit adjective?
I'll give it to you.
Yeah, how Kubrickian it would feel. It felt like it teetered on the edge. It felt very much like a standard war film you would find in terms of thematically and mm-hmm. visual styles, but then every so often certain things would happen where you were like, oh yeah, this is Kubrick, or this is the beginnings of the obsessive compulsive Kubrick we'll see in his future films.
My job, I'm a movie cameraman for a living, and there's like little technical things, like I feel like a camera person picks up on. It looked grittier than a lot of movies at the time, like especially war movies. The film looked, there's a term called push processing, where you underexpose the film, and then with the development, you push it up to get it to the right exposure, which adds kind of grain and does stuff with the contrast. It looked like he did that with, especially in the trenches. I also remember reading somewhere that he studied a lot of like photographs of actual people in the trenches. Mm. And a lot of the kind of long, it looked like Steadicam shots, but it was before Steadicam was invented. It's kind of amazing he managed to do dolly shots like that.
Yeah.
But a lot of that stuff and a lot of the close-ups in the trenches and all feels grainy and gritty and very, very unpolished, very raw, which you wouldn't expect from a film of this era, like, necessarily.
Right.
Coming off, like, the propaganda films of World War II.
That's what was most shocking to me, I think, is this is 1957.
Okay.
And as you said, I got a very strong vibe of the grit and the the dirtiness of it.
Yeah.
And you leave the movie feeling dirty. At this time, it's a lot of patriotism. I was real confused at the beginning because there's a lot of very American actors playing French soldiers. So for a while, I was trying to figure out, oh, is this like the Americans working with the French? What's going on? I'm not as familiar with World War One history. So it took me a little bit because Kirk Douglas is so American.
He is.
But it almost gives them an excuse to get away with the lack of patriotism. It's a very cynical film and very anti-war in ways that I feel like if he'd made it about the U.S. would have gotten him in a lot more trouble.
Yeah, it's definitely the fact that it's French. I mean, there's certain historical aspects of it. You know, it was before the Americans joined the war in 1917. But I think it's a universal film about war and just kind of human nature and hierarchies of power. I'm a big kind of history buff, and I really love the world wars because I just find them fascinating. They're the two largest events in human history in every respect. World War One was just absolutely just in terms of just what it said about the last like 300 years before it, about the last 300 years before World War One were about we can be rational, we can discipline people and use our rationality to control people and make the world a better place and have these large-scale projects. The problem is when you have strict control over people, when you have these hierarchies where nominally logical hierarchies where there isn't accountability from the bottom up, where there isn't things that are variables like the human experience, if they aren't taken into account, they lead to atrocities like World War One and right. like World War Two. It's really captured, especially the last scene. I know I'm completely going out of order, but the last scene, I'm still kind of emotional. Like it's really moving, and it's really, I definitely shed a tear or two.
Yeah.
During that scene.
Well, it's fascinating because the whole film posits the greed of men is just our ultimate folly. And it's beyond just the war and how horrible it is. It's what kicks everything off is this horrible colonel. I can't remember what rank he was, but whatever it was, he's basically offered a promotion to do the suicide run, and to him it's like, great, I get a promotion. All I have to do is kill like half my men. Awesome. And it's like just the sheer kind of paper pushing mentality of it is disturbing. And the film kind of it starts off in a way, it's a lot of, I think early on I recognized a lot of the Kubrick flourishes as far as the production design went and the sets.
Oh yeah.
Lots of grand sets where you really get the sense of scale and the sense of there's like this elegance to everything you're seeing. But
contrasted with the grit in the trenches and the mud and the bodies.
So you have these people sitting behind desks making these decisions and
dancing in royal ballrooms.
Right. And sacrificing men's lives for the sake of like, yes, you'll get more pedigree and you'll get more notoriety. And just, you know, these guys just get them to do the thing and you'll get your glory.
They're cogs in a machine. They're as significant as, you know, the raw materials that are traded in the stock market.
Yeah.
They're numbers on a page. They're not human beings to these people.
When the film was released, it was understandably considered controversial, specifically in France, for obvious reasons, which isn't surprising. It's shocking to think of this film in context. We talked a little bit about it beforehand, where for films made outside the U.S., this kind of style and pessimism isn't unheard of. But the level of reality in the film and the level of kind of,
even the performances in the 50s, even for foreign filmmakers, performance felt a little more exaggerated, a little more cartoonish. It was just the era, that the time these films were made, actors were just much more outlandish, and these performances are so they will explode from time to time, and particularly the villain of the piece, whose name I can't remember, is he
the general?
Yeah, is he MacReady? That's his name. Okay. The actor is George MacReady. He plays Brigadier General Paul Moreau. He's the most cartoonish character in the whole thing, which is almost interesting. It's like the villainy is so horrific, you can't portray it as anything but cartoonish in a way.
And again, just to like a lot of that stuff, and it seems completely outlandish, and it seems complete. Just in the time we live, generals don't talk that way. Even like politicians or people on Department of Defense, they don't talk that way because we've gone through world wars, because we've, you know, seen just mass slaughter of people like this, and we've realized kind of the human cost of war. But at the time, it really was the first thing of its kind, and that's how they thought. They saw it as duty and honor, and a lot of those generals in World War One were coming from the Franco-Prussian War from the 1870s, and it's a very different war. There was a lot of kind of prelude to, you know, mechanized warfare, but it was still kind of Napoleonic almost. And you know, this romanticism about war, and then also coupled with a sort of technocratic, bureaucratic way of viewing people and management. I don't think he's like Snidely Whiplash. I don't think he's a mustache twirling villain. You get that a little bit. He has the facial scar. He's definitely a villain, but it's not unrealistic. Like, it's how those people thought.
Well, it's also, I think it's meant to be representative of the soldiers, the ones who are fighting the fights and who are suffering. They are very grounded in their performances and very real and very human. Even the more exaggerated characters, such as the guy who's kind of mentally unstable, who is one of the men accused at the end. But they're all very human, and their performances are very understated. And you compare that to the higher ups who are making these orders, and they're very elegant, and everything they say has a dramatic flourish to it that is very disconnected from reality, which I think is a commentary on how Kubrick sees war. These very disconnected men who don't have any semblance of humanity, almost.
Yeah.
Whereas you have these soldiers who are very, and Kirk Douglas is kind of the bridge, very in touch with his humanity, but willing to stand up to these guys with his, just kind of that noble humanity.
It's two kind of interesting. One's pretty ironic. I love that the general says that he's not a paper pusher. He goes to the battle with them, and he's in some fortified bunker looking through a periscope.
Right.
And, you know, the irony of that.
Ordering attacks on his own
men. and I love that just irony of him saying, oh, I'm with you in the battle. And yeah, technically he's at the front lines.
Yes.
But
he comes in to rally them up. And that amazing shot, that amazing dolly shot, that first real sense of like, oh, yeah, this feels like Kubrick. But he's walking through. And like, how are you doing, men? And they're like, I hate everything. And he's like, great, let's go. You know, it's just completely out of touch.
The moment, like, I think the first Kubricky shot was one of the first shots in the film, in my opinion. It was looking out at the anthill, which is the German fortification they have to take, or, you know, which is impossible for them to take. It's like a landscape shot, and there's like a weird kind of black, it looks like a mountain range on top, like coming down from the sky.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you wonder what that is. And it pulls back, and you realize you're looking through like a little peephole in the trenches, and it's kind of mud and dirt coming down.
Yeah. I remember that. It was such a great shot.
Yeah.
And what was really interesting in terms of his visual sense and the cinematography and the camera is there were a lot more, the energy of the camera was much more pronounced, I feel. It's been a long time since I've seen Dr. Strangelove, but even in that, he moved his camera, but it became more picturesque. The movements became more fluid. Not that they weren't fluid in here, but there were a lot of dramatic dolly push-ins, pull-outs, zooms. And zooms, and very, very evocative camera moves, like very energetic camera movements.
If you... Barry Lyndon is probably the most kind of contained his camera movements are. It's all very... It looks like Renaissance paintings every frame. And then if you look at, like, Clockwork Orange, it's just handheld, wide lens, yeah, like slow weird zooms. Angles.
Yeah.
The scene where he beats the woman with the giant penis. It's all weird, like, angles and stuff and just moving around.
I don't know why I laughed at that. Oh. He beats the woman. It's just so absurd.
It's
true.
It's so weird, like, thinking about that movie after a black and white, gritty, horrible war movie, and then thinking back to Clockwork Orange and the bombastic, colorful frames.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
insane to think that this is 1957. So 1968 was 2001, his first color film, but also just a decade after Paths of Glory.
Yeah,
which is insane. I mean, it was this Spartacus, which I guess was color, wasn't it? So I'm wrong. But Spartacus, which is, as far as I understand, epic but impersonal for him. But then you go into Doctor Strangelove, and then you go into 2001. And Spartacus may be the missing gap between this and 2001, but like you're saying, to think of something that, you know, when you think of Kubrick, you don't usually think gritty war film with very strong human emotions.
Yeah,
a lot of his films, that was, I think, what was most shocking to me, is there these actors are giving very naturalistic performances, and typically Kubrick is very controlled and sterile, and the performances he gets are usually very almost robotic and calculated,
stilted.
And
I believe a lot of that's by design. A lot of 2001 especially, like the astronauts are very muted and almost robotic, and it's funny that Hal is more of a human.
Right, that's the irony of that film.
I think the birthday, when Hal says happy birthday, and he's completely...
He's like, whatever.
Like, checked out.
Yeah,
a lot of really beautiful performances, and I expected more speechifying, more, you know, bombast, and more, you know, kind of, I don't want to say handball, but more, you know, like soliloquies from Kirk Douglas, and it's rather contained for what I expected.
But you do get to see the first shot of him is a money shot of him with his shirt off.
Those high waisted,
could not resist getting Kirk Douglas's pants. Shirt off. And I have to say, I mentioned this to you, but he looks so much like Michael Douglas. I don't think I've ever seen, at least Kirk Douglas in like his younger days, I don't think I've seen him in a performance, because I haven't seen Spartacus, as we already said, but just seeing it was like immediately his voice and his silhouette, especially, it was like, oh my God, they look so much alike. But you're right. I was expecting, again, I wasn't sure what to expect.
Yeah.
I knew just based on the decade this was made, and I expected a little more of a heroic kind of, I didn't know anything as far as, I didn't realize it was about the French army, so I thought it was going to be kind of like maybe a gritty look at war, but maybe like the heroism of the American. And with Kirk Douglas in that lead role, you're almost expecting it, because he's such a he's got a classic American look to him. And and up to the end, he shows up and he talks to his boss and basically was like, hey, I just found this out that this guy ordered the firing squad to fire on his own men. Just saying, the artillery. Yeah, exactly. So you're trained by movies of this era to expect like, oh, he's going to save the day. And he doesn't. They get killed anyway. They are executed. And it's a very depressing kind of thing. It almost reminds me of Vertigo with Jimmy Stewart. You expect Jimmy Stewart to be so heroic, and he's always been the good guy, and to have him play this very twisted, almost perverted role is very unsettling when you're not prepared for it. It reminded me a lot of that in this. Not that he's perverted or anything, but just the fact that he doesn't, like, he's very heroic, and you admire him, and you're always connected to him, but it was disconcerting to see him like fighting and he be noble and then he loses in the end.
Did you get like Calgary vibes from the three posts?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's very symbolic there. It's interesting how each of the condemned feels like a real person. They all have their own personality. They all feel like very different people with different stories.
Yeah, you really feel for, we haven't spent a lot of time with them up to that point, but very quickly in the jail cell, they all stand. Well, I mean, to be fair, the one guy with the cut on his head, he, you get the sense of his moral compass when he calls out.
Exactly.
The sergeant, which isn't too hard to be like, you killed a man and now you're trying to hide it. But we get a sense of who he is. We've spent a little bit of time with each of them, except for Tyrell, who we realized quickly, Joe, I think Joseph Turkel, but he's the bartender in The Shining, and he's Tyrell in Blade Runner.
Very distinctive face.
Yeah, very distinctive face, but very young. I've never seen him so energized in a performance before.
Oh, yeah.
Those are two very, I mean, they're very, very methodical, calculated films, The Shining and Blade Runner. So to see him very passionate and angry was almost shocking.
Yeah, it was. The jail cell stuff, especially with the priest, I got a Bergman sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Like, obviously a little bit faster paced and a little bit, but thematically, is what I'm saying. With these three men all condemned to die and their thoughts on religion and death, very moving.
Yeah. And early on, you have that conversation between the two men about, like, nobody wants to die, but how would you prefer to die?
Yeah.
And you would prefer to die without knowing about it? Would you men don't want to feel pain, but men don't mind dying. So just the conversation.
That little aside about the cockroach is very, God, it's so bleak. I'm still like trying to even like formulate thoughts just because it leaves such a miserable impression on you.
Yeah.
World War One,
not fun. No, one lesson we can take from this movie.
My Yelp rating would be pretty low. I not recommend. I would leave some nasty comments about World War One.
Were there any other specific visuals that you were impressed by? One of the ones that stood out to me very early on was the shot of the flare in the sky that reveals the bodies on the ground, which was like very early on, a very unsettling shot that you don't expect in a movie from this era for them to get away with.
You know, one detail, this is not like a shot per se, but there's a technique that was developed around this part of the war called the rolling barrage, where they would essentially, you'd have the infantry charge and you'd aim your guns, your big artillery, 20-30 feet in front of them to create a smoke screen and to just smash everything in their path. And you had to time it just right. You had to, if you were too far away, you know, they'd be open to enemy fire. They'd be visible. You wouldn't be smashing through barbed wire and traps and mines and stuff like that. If you're too close, you're going to blow up your own troops. Mm. And it was mentioned that essentially in passing that the artillery officer who wouldn't fire on his own troops, the general says, your barrage was short. And you could see some of the shells like hitting around the men. And it's just an interesting detail. And again, just trying to put yourself in the shoes of somebody marching like that and realizing your own artillery is just mowing you down.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
And just so many experiences in that war that there were people who drowned in mud. There were, you know, gas attacks, obviously, just people having to shoot their own friends who were dying in agony.
Right.
It was the first war that they mentioned shell shock as well. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first wars where PTSD was noticed and you can see why. There was like the Russo-Japanese war before, which had some of the machine guns, and even the end of the American Civil War had some kind of horrific conditions, but nothing like the First World War. Nothing like Passchendaele or Verdun.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the scene of, I think you don't get a sense of the brutality the movie's capable of until that first scene they charge, and suddenly it feels very intense and very, I mean, there, it's this wide kind of swooping shot of them following them along, and you're very in the trenches with them. And you feel it, and it feels grungy, and it feels dirty, and again, not heroic. And we never see the enemy the whole time. We are very much in their perspective. We never see a German shooting at them. We never see anything, as far as I'm aware. We hear it, but we mostly are seeing them, like just them reacting, them getting mowed down, and everyone collapsing, and the explosions. But
we do see one German.
When is that?
At the very last scene.
That's true. Well, technically we do. Yeah, at the end, yes.
It's interesting because...
Well, it's interesting. And then, again, well, go ahead. I don't want to steal your thought.
The whole movie is about duty and heroism and what is it, the human cost and all that stuff, but it's rather abstract. You have these people who feel like real people, but what is Kirk Douglas fighting for? What is the idealism is what he's accused of? What is it he sees in humanity? What are we losing? And the last scene of the film is a captured German woman who's obviously traumatized and with tears rolling down her face, brought in front of a crowd of the men who were assembled for the firing squad. They're rowdy. Most of them seem drunk. And she's forced to sing. And absolutely moving scene. Again, like I legitimately cried a little bit. You see, and Kirk Douglas sees through a window, the power of human connection, the power of artistic expression, of shared humanity. And it's kind of reversed because it's treated as abstract and distant throughout all these proceedings and hierarchies and, I don't know, kind of bean pushing and, you know, bean counting and all that stuff. And the end illustrates so perfectly what Kirk Douglas was fighting for and what the generals and the politicians and everyone else seems to forget. Human connection, human compassion, the ability to be moved and to live artistically, that's what's being lost. And you see it in the face of every one of those men at the end.
Right.
And it's haunting. It's absolutely beautiful.
But it's to bring it back to that point, that's very, I mean, you pointed it out, that you don't see the Germans in the movie until the very end. And the only German you see ends up basically inspiring and instilling hope in the men. And instead of we're seeing they're being destroyed. You never see the enemy, but they're being destroyed by the people who are supposed to be leading them to victory. And instead you have this German woman at the end, the only glimpse of humanity they get.
I don't read it as inspirational. I see it's pretty tragic. You see these people realizing what they've sacrificed, what they've lost. They've lost their humanity, and they see it in that woman, and they feel it in that moment. And it's
I do agree with that, but at the same time, the fact that they sing with her to me suggests the emotional connection they're striving for. But maybe you could read that as emotional loss. Maybe they're trying to regain something they can't have again.
And outside the room, they're ordered back to the front.
Right.
And yeah,
it's a depressing movie.
Welcome to our fun depressing podcast, guys.
But yes, it's a great podcast. But no, it is true. I mean, but it is fascinating that the only time you do see a German in the movie is a scene that's meant to enrich the humanity, and they connect on an emotional level with what is supposed to be the enemy they're fighting. And really, at the end of the day, the only enemy they have is their own people. The people making the decisions for them,
the people and the hierarchies and systems in place that protect the people in power and are completely arbitrary and unfair to anyone who has any complaint about anybody above them, in any capacity or any real demand for justice of any sort. It's obvious that all the systems and in the court martial and then just systemically in the country and the army are designed to protect the people in power and subjugate those below them. And obviously, you know, it's a reflection of the times,
right?
But at the same time,
it's a good thing we got away from that. Am I right, America?
I view it as a warning too. Like, it's, we still have systems that benefit people in power. I'm not trying to be political or speechify.
Why not? Let's do it. But I mean, it's a very explicit political message.
Of course. But whenever you have a system where it is a hierarchy like that and commands are to be obeyed without question, where systems are in place to enforce order and, you know, downstream in a kind of arborescent hierarchical model, you have things like this. This might be the extreme of it, mm-hmm. we've seen so far in humanity. But you know, look at World War II, look at the firebombings of Tokyo, look at the atom bomb, look at the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. You, when you have systems where you can't question the orders coming down, when you, when you're a cog in the machine and you have no sort of voice or ability to demand real justice, you have atrocity.
Yeah.
You have complete madness, like the charnel houses that Europe became in World War One and World War Two.
Yeah.
And you know, to this day, we still have systems like that, militarily and otherwise, that benefit the people at the top and suppress the people at the bottom.
And that's the, I think that was the most surprising thing, is how relevant that movie felt. I was not expecting that. You can kind of tell from the sense of this conversation how kind of shell shocked we are by the movie. But I was not expecting kind of a topically relevant film for this day and age, watching Paths of Glory. But it's really also, you know, beyond, it's about the selfishness of man when people in power are willing to sacrifice, willing to turn a blind eye to sacrifice to benefit themselves. That's really at the core of what is destroying everything. When someone says, oh, well, this is going to benefit me, therefore that's all that really matters, when you lose the ability to empathize. When you, like at the end of the film, when they're finally, there's a connection, a human connection between two sides that are supposed to be warring against each other. When you lose that, you get exactly what this film is condemning.
When you, it's the same if you're willing to sacrifice men in the trenches, or if you're willing to sacrifice the environment and the ecological stability of the planet for your own personal benefit. If the general was a person of the day, he'd probably be a CEO of a major corporation who, through his actions, is destroying the planet and, you know, increasing the misery of human lives.
Right.
And at the same time, reserving a spot on a spaceship to be the first person on Mars while everybody else suffers with boiling seawater. It's the same thing. I hate to be so bleak, but like it's the mood the movie leaves you with.
Yeah.
The kind of beautiful thing, especially the end of the war, soldiers towards the end of the war in the last couple of battles refused to fight, turned their bayonets on their officers. There were mutinies all over the front, especially in Russia after the Soviet Revolution. A lot of Russian soldiers, the war continued after that revolution, while peace agreements were, you know, in effect. And when it was amazing towards the end of the war, movements of socialists and egalitarian movements of all stripes, anarchists popped up, people saying, we want a voice, we want power, or otherwise, you know, we're nothing but chattel. We're nothing but meat for the grinder. If we don't have political power or autonomy to make our own choices and control our lives and our destinies. And it was a real movement, especially at the end of the war. There's some hope there that, you know, the more you tighten the levers of power on humanity, the more that voice, that singing, that human connection, that indefinable kind of human desire for life and desire for autonomy will come through.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess that's the most hopeful thing you can take away from
this extremely bleak and depressing film.
And the current situation we find ourselves in today.
Yeah. So outside of the thematic elements, and outside of the ending, which I think we've both stated as one of our favorite moments.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, yeah.
I love how I expected, like everybody says, it's a moving film, and I expected Kirk Douglas to give some rah-rah,
rousing, like let's go get them, men,
or even like, you know, a noble doomed, you know, I expected his defense speech at the trial to be the moving moment,
right? And he never gets a chance to talk.
And it's amazing how instead of a speech or, you know, some great line of dialogue, there's many of them. It's a scene of quiet singing and people crying, and just shots of faces. That's the defining moment of the film and the most moving kind of thing that sticks with you. I appreciated the subtlety and the tact of that.
What else about this film do you think did you admire the most from a technical standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint or performance? Was there anything that stood out, a specific scene or anything like that?
I like the lighting a lot. I thought that a lot of the close-ups, especially, there's just a lot of grit. You see like almost every pore, which is kind of amazing. They did a great job with the Criterion version of this. Just how dirty and muddy they got Kirk Douglas during the battle. It feels a world apart from the propaganda films of World War II,
right?
Which were like less than 20 years before, you know.
Yeah, and I mean they were still making movies that were celebrating that achievement, you know, that victory and the heroes involved, and no doubt there were heroes, but it's also very striking to see something so frank and so disproving come out in that same era.
Oh yeah, it's interesting. You see the trend, and Kubrick was part of this. There's a movie called Strategic Air Command, I believe, with Jimmy Stewart. It was late 40s, I want to say, early 50s, sometime in there. But he plays a character based on Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Strategic Air Command. He was the head of essentially nuclear operations in the United States and in Europe. And he's portrayed very heroically, a military man, tough, tough military dude.
Always is the right thing.
And he, true story, he smoked a cigar on like a bomber, and the pilot said, "You need to put that out. You'll blow up the plane. The plane will blow up." And he looks at the plane and he goes, "She wouldn't dare." You know, that sort of thing. And just a few years later, Dr. Strangelove comes out, and a very similar character in that movie is portrayed as a buffoon, a madman. And it's interesting, you see these seeds of social consciousness and the sort of madness that war is emerge. And it's interesting, Kubrick in both Dr. Strangelove and Paths of Glory definitely helped move the needle to, you know, culture and film that we see in the 60s and 70s.
Right. So overall, where are you able to think where this might place in your ranking of Kubrick's films, or
his film? They're all impossible to rate. They all are so different. They all have such different thematic elements going on.
Dr. Strangelove, I mean, it's a comedy. It's a dark comedy, but it's a comedy. And I think that's surprised me just how genuinely funny it is. But as we've discussed, this feels singular in the fact that it feels so realistic and raw and human.
Yeah. You look at something like Full Metal Jacket, which is the first film I really kind of delved into with Kubrick, and I've watched that so many times. And it's beautiful and it's amazing, but the characters feels stilted, but like technically, like the technicals and the nuances and the kind of the way it's bifurcated and the kind of themes about like the infantile and the feminine that need to be killed before indoctrination, represented by Gomer Pyle in the first half and then the female sniper in the second half, and like all these kind of nuanced ideas that are under the surface. It's great and all that, and I love that, but you kind of lose some of the surface level just expression and emotion and the things that kind of tug on your heartstrings, I guess. I don't know if this movie would yield the same sort of results if you did an autopsy on it, I guess.
Right.
you pulled it apart like you do something Full Metal Jacket or The Shining or Eyes Wide Shut, where you every line and reference and there's so many layers, but like the pure surface level beauty and the way it moves and what it says, you don't really need anything more than that. And I find that beautiful in and of itself. It's utterly different than his later films, but I mean, it's a masterpiece. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Right. Because it's so naturalistic and because it's so removed from his his very controlled environments where every little piece is exactly what he needs it to be. It's an outlier of the films I've seen of his, but it's also very much on par with them in a completely different way.
it's almost like every film of his is an outlier. Like, you know, you know, they all have some like connecting style and, you know, ideas and stuff, but each one feels, kind of like the black sheep of the family. Dr. Strangelove is a comedy. 2001 is very abstract. Barry Lyndon is very formal and, slow moving and, and long. And then something like Clockwork Orange is so bombastic and violent. Like, they all feel so different, despite like surface level similarities. It's really incredible that one man could, the same man who created something like Clockwork made something like this. Because it feels like a completely different, different director. Obviously, it's a different age and different, you know, sensibilities as a filmmaker, but I wish he made this Napoleon film.
I know. That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
So I guess final ratings. Let's make our scale on a scale of 1 to 5, obviously American Frenchmen. How many, with 5 being the highest and 1 being the lowest, how many would you give Paths of Glory just based on this first viewing?
I it's hard to even like say ratings for this sort of thing. I'd have to give it a 5. It's, I expected, again, like more speechifying, more, I don't know, like witty or like dramatic or moving dialogue. And I don't know why I expected that from a Kubrick film. It's not what he does. I probably would have given it like a 4 until that final scene that just, I don't know, just plays on your heartstrings and really kind of moves you and makes you really remember why Kirk Douglas and what he's saying matters. Like what is being lost and what is, you know, what is at stake in the movie. And you leave just haunted by that scene. So 5.
I'm with you. I give it 5. It was so very stunning in a way you wouldn't expect from him, but also just very powerful film watching experience. Hey, Hate My Life. I hope you do too, audience. But Dan, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me for the first episode of 2019. Would have been nice to start it off a little happier, but that's okay. We
almost watched True Stories, guys.
True Stories. We'll get that on the agenda, I think. We'll make that happen. But Dan, is there anywhere you're not on social media?
Not really.
No, good for you.
Yeah. If you want to come meet me in person, here's my address.
Have a real conversation in person, without warning. Show up at his front porch.
I just said my address, but Sean cut it out.
That's and if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter at @YaySeanDoorman. And if you like what you're hearing, if you like the show, please feel free to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening. If there's a rating system, share this with your friends. We really appreciate the support. You guys have been awesome, and I really appreciate the feedback I've been getting. And, thank you so much for tuning in. Again, we will try to be happier next time around.
I won't.
Dan won't.